Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. We're going to talk today about Park Heights, a swath of northwest Baltimore almost twice the size of New York's Central Park. A half century ago, the area was what is known as a streetcar suburb, a lively mix of homes and businesses along streetcar lines. European immigrants were drawn to the area. At one point, around 60,000 people lived in the neighborhoods that make up Park Heights. Today, half that number remain. As a result, vacant buildings number in the thousands. The median household income is among the lowest in the city, and the area is extremely segregated. HIV, homicide, and drug overdose are among the leading causes of death there. The city has been wrestling for years with how to address the problems that plague Park Heights. In 2006, it adopted the Park Heights Master Plan. 10 years later, the city is well on its way to acquiring and demolishing roughly 260 buildings. More than 60 families have been relocated, and last spring, the city started a search for a master developer to lead the project. What's next for Park Heights? How will the plan avoid the fate of other urban renewal projects in the city that have been slow to progress? How do you attract developers to an area that's been so neglected? Two guests will join me this hour. Later in the hour, we'll hear from urban planner and architect Klaus Philipson. But first, Cheo Hurley is executive director of the nonprofit organization Park Heights Renaissance. Its mission is to help move the master plan forward. Cheo Hurley also sits on the board of WIPR and on the city's planning commission. Welcome to Midday.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm just great. How are you?
Good. I'm doing well.
So tell us how big the redevelopment area is and what the city has done so far in that area.
Right. So the Park Heights master plan is a 1,500-acre undertaking. It starts at Northern Parkway and is bounded by Wabash Avenue to the west and Greenspring to the east, and it terminates at Park Circle right above Druid Hill Park. Specifically, though, there are 62 acres in Central Park Heights that are in the process, as you mentioned, of being acquired, individuals being located, families being located, and demolition happening right in the middle of Park Heights. And that's bounded by, like, Virginia Avenues, Denmore Avenue, Reisterstown Road, Pimlico Road to the east. That's where we are right now. We're in the demolition phase. Probably, I would say, 80% of that 62 acres have been demoed. But you have to remember, outside of that...
About how much? What proportion has been demolished?
About 80% of that 62 acres has been demolished.
So the city's acquired... The city owns these properties and has paid to wipe out the buildings that were there.
Yes.
All this without knowing exactly what's going to go there.
Right. So I guess part of this process, and as you mentioned, this is a very long process, right? I mean, we started this under the O'Malley administration during the Park Heights Master Plan. Mm-hmm. And now we've moved, and it's 2016. We're still working on it. So you have to remember, we went through a global recession, which dramatically impacted real estate development throughout the world. Right. And so that slowed up some of the redevelopment. Also, the anticipated video lottery terminal funding or slots funding did not come.
Let's
online.
Talk about that.
Right.
What is that?
All right. So as most people in Maryland know, we have gambling now.
Oh, yes, we do.
Right. And so initially the thought was that slot machines would go at Pimlico Racecourse. The state delegation worked with the community and fought against having more gambling in the community. We already have a lottery, we have a ton of liquor stores, et cetera. And they just said, listen, we can't afford to put slot machines at Pimlico right now. They thought it would bring something bad to the neighborhood. But as part of that legislation, Park Heights directly benefits from gambling in the state of Maryland. So there are three casinos, Live, Horseshoe, and the one in Montgomery and Prince George's County that's coming online. Those casinos will contribute to funding coming to Park Heights.
And you're already getting.
We already get some. So
how much do you get? What's the magnitude of what we're talking about?
So the way it works is the entire area. So it's not just Southern Park Heights, right? It's Southern Park Heights in a 1 mile radius around Pimlico Racecourse. So that affects neighborhoods like Glen, Mount Washington. There are some to the west, some other neighborhoods to the west that receive funding.
So it's a different footprint than what one described, than the Park Heights Renaissance footprint.
Right. So out of the funds is 100% of slots funding coming to Park Heights, Southern Park Heights, in the 1 mile radius. Southern Park Heights gets 75% of that cut.
And so that's what in dollars?
So it's steadily been ticking up, and we're only in year three of getting the funding. And so this year, I think we're estimated at somewhere around $6 million for the area. But remember, off the top, the city takes most of that money to help to do the demolition.
I see. So that money is paying for the demolition you described a few minutes ago.
Yes, yes, yes. And so all of this is really structured. So there is the Pimlico Community Development Authority, or PCDA. They are the authority that recommends to the mayor how funds should be spent in Park Heights. And so my group and other groups apply for funding year after year. Now, PHR was actually created to kind of be the master developer.
Park Heights Renaissance.
Right. Back in 2007, we were created to really be the one to execute the master plan for Park Heights, similar to what EBDI has done in East Baltimore. We're a nonprofit, but it was created pretty much by the community and the city and the state all working together.
So there's this flow of several million dollars a year to the community, not necessarily to Park Heights Renaissance, to your organization,
although
you apply for it.
Right. So we do receive some funding for our administration. We pay some salaries, but we also, like this year, are executing numerous programs in the community, one of which being our Park Heights Clean and Green Team, where I go out and I hire individuals from the community. I purchased equipment, and they go out and cut grass and pick up trash in areas that haven't been hit by DPW. So it's a twofold program, right? Like, I want to give people in the community a chance, an opportunity to work, and I also want to keep the neighborhood clean as well, working with the city. So
that is Cheo Hurley, executive director of the nonprofit organization Park Heights Renaissance, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about whether things are finally moving for a redevelopment in the Park Heights area. You can be part of the conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email to midday@wypr.org. Will Hanna has called us. He serves on the Park Heights Community Development Corporation. Will Hanna, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I just wanted to add a contribution to the conversation. Most of what Mr. Hurley, I can reiterate some of what Mr. Hurley has said, but I wanted to give some from a historic perspective, is that we've been going through this process. The current master plan has been in place since 2006, but in the Park Heights community, this has been for probably a 25 to 30 year process. It started where it ended up in SLOTS revenue with the VLP funding, which the community started receiving those funds in 2011. So for the past 5 years, the community has been receiving, the state and the city has been receiving those funds for the Park Heights community for a tune of an average of about $4.5 million a year. The first year was about $900,000, and then after that it's been growing since then. So you're talking about a total of somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 million that's been accumulated in SLOTS funding. But this started before then, and you're talking about another $500,000 a year that was contributed to the Park Heights community, which started as the Racetrack Impact Fund, which was about $500,000 a year that's been in place since 1976. So that's the history of some of that funding. But going forward, there are a lot of unique opportunities in Park Heights. One is that there's been a state-approved affordable housing community land trust, and I think that's one of the assets that can be used to put in place there. But what we've seen is that when you put funding in certain places and it goes to place out, sometimes that takes away from what the neighborhood can achieve on its own. And that's what we've seen. We've seen $500,000 a year go to, as Mr. Hurley said, place out. But there are some
I'm sorry, options. I didn't get that. You've seen the money go to what?
To pay salaries. Since 2007, that $500,000 that's been contributed to the Park Heights community has gone mostly to pay salaries. So you're talking about $4.5 to $5 million at least that has gone to pay salaries, and not a lot of work has been done in the neighborhood, in the community itself.
So
drive to Park Heights, and you can see that.
So I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, Will Hanna, but it sounds to me as if you're saying you're skeptical of how the slots money is being used?
I think that there's a better alternative. I think that if there is more community control of those funding, what we've seen is there's been somewhat of a lack of oversight from whether it's our state officials or at the city level of how those funds have been used and how they've been used over time. And I'm not just talking about since the creation of PHR. We're talking about historically that we've seen this demise and this breakdown in the community because there's been a lack of dialogue between the community and between the powers that be, so to speak. So see $40 plus million that we can identify right now, $48 million that has gone through Park Heights and is not funded. So when you look at part of your question was, how do you attract developers to that area? Well, when you have an area that has 38 liquor establishments, and we've done some positive things with liquor legislation, with PHR, with us as well, that have been effective in doing some of that. We've gotten rid of 50 liquor licenses in Park Heights, for example. Now there are remaining 38 liquor establishments. Do some of those things. Some of the initiatives that have done have not worked, but I think you have to keep trying and plugging in things that will work until something sticks, kind of. But there's not been a comprehensive plan from the community that says this is what the community wants. Right now, we're working on an outdated master plan. We're working on a master plan that was approved in 2006, that process started in 2004. So now the needs of the community have changed, but we're still working on an old document.
Will Hanna, let me give Cheo Hurley a chance to respond to some of what you say. I appreciate all the background that you have given us, and obviously, Cheo Hurley, Park Heights Renaissance, doesn't have as long a history as the history Will Hanna just gave us of this money. Mm-hmm. But he's saying it actually undercuts the community's ability to do things.
Yeah, Mr. Hanna, actually, he would know. He used to be an employee at Park Heights Renaissance prior to running for election for a state delegate. He and I worked closely together in the past. And, this has kind of been a long time, a long process. He's correct. There used to be racetrack impact funds that initially helped kind of seed Park Heights Renaissance. But this has really been a totally comprehensive process, right? The master planning process probably took about 2.5 years, and it predated me, but it was a fully comprehensive process, including the community. That process ended in 2006, and then an urban renewal plan was adopted in 2008. And Park Heights Renaissance, like I said, was created in 2007. And so, I'm not sure. I think he said 2011 that VLT funding came in. Park Heights Renaissance hasn't really seen any of that money until like 2013. When we really started seeing slots funding, because you got to remember, if you go back and check the dates of when the slot machine, the casinos actually opened, when those funds would have come. So they had to get going, they had to be in operation. Then the state has to do their calculations and figure out how much each casino is making, and then that money funnels down. And as you can imagine, it takes a long time.
Well, I guess one of the things we're going to need to take a short break here. And Will Hanna, I appreciate your calling us and putting these facts on the table early in this conversation. We need to take a break, but I think one of the things I'm trying to understand is looking at the prospects for redevelopment in Park Heights, which doesn't have a big anchor the way we've seen in West Baltimore with the University of Maryland Medical Center or in East Baltimore with Johns Hopkins. I don't know whether this income stream from the gambling, whether that helps equalize the appeal that a big anchor might have. That's one of the things I think we might talk about after we take this short break. Okay. Again, you can be part of this conversation. What approach do you think the city should take to revitalizing areas like Park Heights? Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about the troubled Northwest Baltimore community of Park Heights. The city has been planning to revitalize the area for a decade. Now there appears to be some movement. With me in studio is Cheo Hurley, executive director of the nonprofit organization Park Heights Renaissance. He also serves on the City Planning Commission and, full disclosure, on WYPR's board. And now we're joined by urban planner and architect Klaus Philipson, president of ArcPlan Incorporated, an architecture firm specializing in community revitalization. I'm very glad you could join us. Klaus, wrote a blog post in June that was critical of the approach to revitalizing Park Heights. What were your main concerns?
The use of funds. You started already talking about how the money is used that comes through the benefits agreement and or the money that comes out of city coffers, and whether they are used strategically and whether we learn the lessons that we had to learn in Sandtown, for example, where I have been active on revitalization, rehabilitation for 25 years or so. And, you know, Sandtown has recently received a lot of attention, and the question as to, after $130 million of investment, what is there to show for it? And so one of the lessons is that it's not all about bricks and mortar. To rebuild a community, it's also mostly about the people. And so when you use the strategic funds or the funds, and then this is not strategic, to use them for demolition and for relocation of the last remaining residents that are holding out in the community in certain areas that are heavily disinvested. And some of these residents certainly want to be relocated. But when you do that, every time you do that, you're diminishing the social capital of the community further. You are reducing the number of customers for those merchants that are in the area, and you are reducing the tax base in the area. So I'm very skeptical about this approach of cleaning out an entire, and 60 acres is a pretty large area, an entire area and create this clean slate approach and then have a master developer. That was the original attempt.
Yeah, let's separate that out. Let's focus on this clean slate approach. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you tell me, Cheo Hurley, that 80% of the 62 acres mm-hmm. has the buildings have been demolished. Mm-hmm. That sounds to me like a clean slate. Mm-hmm. Would you say that the way what Klaus is describing is a fair description of what's been going on in Park Heights? And why do you think it's a good approach?
Well, let me just start off by saying, I guess I can address Klaus as well as Will. This is a community that is has a 1,500 acre master plan with just 62 acres being clean slated, as Klaus would say, right?
So you're saying the 62 is a small part
of the
overall plan?
It's a very small portion of the overall master plan for Park Heights. And we have 30,000 people who live there. And so, you know, it's a bit of a misnomer to say, hey, PHR or the city or whoever is just use funding and just spent it on salaries. We have spent a significant amount of money and time on people first. So a big reason why a lot of development hasn't happened is because a lot of funding has been used, including slots funding, for educational programs, for safety programs, for kids, for for jobs programs throughout Park Heights, right? When I took over at Park Heights Renaissance, what I wanted to do is really put us on a path to be focused on four areas. And those areas are safety, education, beautification, and then real estate development, right? Like, I realize I come from a finance real estate development background. And listen, you could drop, $1 billion into the middle of Park Heights. But even as Will alluded to, if we continue to have 40-plus liquor stores in this 1,500 acres, if we continue the folks in this community to be, the recipient of lack of jobs, to have a lack of real community policing in the neighborhood, when people don't feel safe, it doesn't matter how much you invest in bricks and mortar. And I agree with you there, Klaus. You have to help the people. You have to change the people. The other thing is, you're not going to have true change in a segregated community. And Park Heights is segregated. Say what you want, right? It's 99% African American, very poor, and that's not going to thrive, right? We need to figure out a way to create an environment where lots of different incomes and races really move to Park Heights. And it is a great neighborhood. You have two subway stations in Park Heights. You're less than a half mile away from a light rail station. You know, you're right by Druid Hill Park. I mean, it's really the prime location, and you go right over Northern Parkway, and it's a, you know, it's very, very different. I'll say that it's very, very different. And all the stats, the negative stats that we have in Park Heights below Northern Parkway, you'll have the exact opposite stats once you walk over Northern Parkway, right? So how do we change that? And that's what we've been trying to do. And I think that the development piece is really just a small portion of that. That 62 acres is really a drop in the bucket for the entire 1,500 acres. There are a ton of other neighborhoods in Park Heights that need to be addressed as well. And, you know, they are being addressed.
Okay, 62 acres is a drop in the bucket. I thought it was like the cornerstone, the keystone, the piece that would make the rest of it happen.
No, I mean, you know, it's going to take several different areas being redeveloped to change the neighborhood. This area was very, very blighted, and so that's why they decided to target. They had very high vacancy in this area, et cetera. But there are other areas in Park Heights that will also need to be addressed as part of the master plan. And so we're trying to figure out how to do that. And, you know, people don't really know. There's probably been $200 million plus of investment in Park Heights over the last 10 to 15 years. Lots of development has actually happened in Park Heights. You just can't see it because it's a very vast area and a lot of these things are tucked away. This will create a prominent development in Central Park Heights.
And first off, I'm really not here to make Tio's life any harder than it is already.
My life is hard.
His existence and Park Heights Renaissance existence is testimony to the fact that they realize that social capital building and community organizing is a key piece. So that, there's no question about that. But the drop in the bucket piece, so 64 acres sitting centrally located in the 1,500 and on both sides of Park Heights Avenue, which is sort of the main street of Park Heights. That is a fairly large area, and the question really comes up, is that the right piece to start a large redevelopment? Why would you pick this? And so the question that I had when I wrote my little blog piece there was, how did they come up with that, and why do they clean it out entirely before they even start the first dollar? You know, do you really need one big master developer? Do you really need to have everything demolished before you can start any infill? And is this the right area? And so when I studied vacancy to value and what the housing department declares as their own lessons, they use Greenmount West and Barclay as the best practices on where they had the most success, and the Able Foundation has in a report kind of verified that those are the two success stories of vacancy to value. And in that, there was TRF as a reinvestment fund that helped bring this along. So the question of how you go from subsidized to market rate, because no way can ever 1,500 acres developed without being market rate. You know, you can't subsidize all of that. So you can't probably even subsidize all of 64 acres. So the question is, where do you strategically use subsidies to create a market, to make a paradigm shift so that there is a market? And I think the lesson should be that this happens not in the middle of disinvestment, not in the most disinvested area, but at the periphery and where the strength is, where you already have stable communities and you can shore them up and you build from there and you build out from the periphery in. So as Gio said, there are some anchors of strength. There's the park, and there are two TOD sites, and that was all part of the 2006 master plan, that those are nodes where one should invest. And so I'm questioning whether this is smart to invest in those 64 acres that the city already delineated in 2009, 1 year after the master plan was updated.
And instead, you're saying invest around the transit stops, around...
Invest strategically. Invest in a way that a market gets created.
That is Klaus Philipson, president of ArcPlan Incorporated, an urban planner and architect, here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Also here in the studio is Cheo Hurley, executive director of the nonprofit Park Heights Renaissance, whose mission is to advance the master plan. And you are welcome to be part of this conversation. You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Before we go any further, since we keep referring to development, there's been a change since June when Park Heights Renaissance, it was Park Heights Renaissance, right, that issued the request for qualifications
It was the City of Baltimore.
Issued this. You all come, show us your qualifications to be the master developer, redeveloper of Park Heights. And now, as I understand it, the thought is nobody really, really meets our standards. We're not going to have a master developer. Am I right that decision has been made? And what is the significance of that?
Right. So we had a formal process to get qualifications. Now, it was not an RFP. And there's a distinction between the two. A request for qualifications is to see if we could get somebody to come in who met minimal qualifications that we would trust enough to even look, you know, take a look at this. We got six applications to come in. We got it down to three interviews. But what we found, in order to have the world-class redevelopment that we think that the residents of Park Heights and the City of Baltimore deserves, you know, those teams didn't really meet that criteria at the time. Now, those groups together, I mean, they had a lot of good pieces, right? They could do, you know, they might be able to do one or two buildings, or they might be good at a certain area. But for a master developer, it does take a certain level of gravitas, a certain level of financial backing, et cetera, to be able
certain
to pull that off. And then we've seen it in Baltimore before. I mean, in East Baltimore, you know, Far City, New East Baltimore Partnership is the master developer. And full disclosure, I worked on that project for 4 years with Far City, kind of saw that process. You know, I think the city is trying to learn, right? They're trying to look at things that have already been done and trying to figure out how we can get development moving in tough neighborhoods within the law, right? I mean, and that's all part of this, right? It's a city-owned land. You just can't give it to somebody. You have to go through a process. And so we went through the process of this. But what we won't do is go through the process and just pick somebody just because to say, hey, we picked someone. It doesn't benefit the community, and it's really it's against everything we want to do in Park Heights. We wouldn't be benefiting the residents there at all with that.
So when I hear this, and you both have worked, you're both experts in development and redevelopment, and I'm not, but it sounds to me as if what you're describing the thought process, where things stand in this long process of thinking of how to revitalize Park Heights fits exactly with what you're saying ought to happen is that it's more now at a stage of seeing what developers motivated by profit as well as wanting to create a good living situation for people.
Well,
what developers will come forward with. Mm-hmm. Which won't necessarily, am I right, be in the 62 acres in the heart of Park Heights.
Well, the fact that they couldn't find a master developer that had the oomph to do it shows to me it's not surprising. I mean, who would be able to do this? Where would the money come from? And how would that work? And where is the demand for this? So these are our questions. You know, when you look at this Sun article that was written in June also, was using the uplands and using Poppleton area as examples,
UN,
and EBDI. Right. And in both cases, at EBDI, East Baltimore Development Inc. near Hopkins with the biopark, and in West Baltimore with the biopark where Poppleton is, you have these strong anchors. And even there, the developers for city and escapes me the name right now. I think it escapes everybody because he keeps on disappearing. That developer on the west side that is supposed to be doing Poppleton, they both have trouble with finding enough people that would populate these buildings because there needs to be a market rate component. You don't have enough money for only affordable.
Okay, but if you're skeptical, who would who can you conceive of who would have had an interest in being the master developer? But I don't even see who's going to be the smaller developers
so you
for
go
individual
in
projects.
A different area where you have better chances is what I'm suggesting, you know, and you're creating a reinvestment fund. So with that money that they are collecting from the benefits over the years,
the gambling,
there could be a reinvestment fund created that would finance these strategic beginning projects that are like the seed projects from which everything else flows.
Cheo, jump in here.
Yeah, so, I want people to not think about Park Heights in terms of just totally being blighted, right? Park Heights is a great community that has a lot of great families and great people that live there and really solid communities. There are certain areas that are really blighted. But for instance, the area around Sana Hospital, there's like no vacancy. The Silburn neighborhood, I mean, it's 98% home ownership, maybe one or two vacant houses, and those will be snapped up quickly. And this area actually buttresses a portion of the major redevelopment area. So in my thought and working with the team, I said, hey, listen, Sinai is our partner. We have a person on our board who is from Sinai. Our board chair sits on the Sinai board. We said, let's build off the strength of the Sinai area, right? And a portion of the 62 acres actually buttresses Sinai and also buttresses Pimlico Elementary Middle School that is a part of the first phase of the 21st Century Schools Initiative, right? And so you have a considerable amount of development that is going to happen like basically east of Park Heights Avenue. And so now I think we're going to look more strategically on how can we build off the strength of Sinai Hospital. I think Klaus is right, and this was brought up. How can we build off the strength of our TODs?
Transit
opportunities. And some of that's being done and looked at. I mean, the fact that the MVA moved to Hilltop, right, the Hilltop Shopping Center, which is in the northern portion of the master plan area, that just shows that development can happen and thrive in Park Heights when it's done strategically. And I think that that's what we're learning. How do we be more strategic? How can we build off of Sinai? How can we build off of what might happen with Pimlico Racecourse? How can we build off the strong neighborhoods and make it a place where, you know, families want to live and kids who grow up and go to great schools and they one day come back and say, hey, you know what? I love living in Park Heights and I want to move back there. So that's what we're doing now. I think it's the right thing to do. I also think that we all already have a ton of really smart people at the table. I think sometimes Baltimore suffers from this thing, like we got to go outside of Baltimore to find people to help save us and help redevelop us. And that's not necessarily the case all the time. Baltimore has a wealth of knowledge and good folks working in government, good for folks like Klaus who are in the private sector, who can all come up with good ideas on how to make communities like Park Heights better. So.
Okay, we're going to take another quick break here. Several people want to be part of this conversation about redevelopment in Baltimore, specifically in Park Heights. You are welcome to call us at 410-662-8780. Or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Much more to talk about when we get back. I'm Sheila Kast. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Kast. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with urban planner and architect Klaus Philipson and with Cheo Hurley, executive director of the nonprofit organization Park Heights Renaissance. We're talking about redevelopment plans for the struggling Northwest Baltimore community of Park Heights. We got an email from Emma, picking up on some of what we were talking about the clean slate approach. She writes, relocation is the perfect model for gentrification, not for renewal that includes the local community. Before I ask you to comment on that, let's talk to Richard, who has called us from Baltimore. Richard, welcome to Midday. Richard?
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air.
Yeah, just two questions. What you just said is more important than my question, but I just want to say this. With all of this redevelopment, how much of this money is directed to the Park Heights Redevelopment Corporation and Foundation and salaries? As I understand it, they're top heavy. From this fella's salary on down, it's 200 plus and it keeps going down, but they're not employing or engaging the community that they're sent in to fix. of that development was sucked up by one developer like he knew and then bought? If he can answer that, why is so much money on over here?
Richard, I appreciate your question. Cheo, did you follow Richard's question?
Yeah, I mean, this has kind of been a constant, I guess, question about Park Heights Renaissance administration, et cetera. You know, this Park Heights Renaissance, like I said, was created, you know, to do this work, and the community was a part of this. Each year, PHR probably receives close to $500,000 in administration. So that's to help to run the office, some staff members. It only covers about two or three staff members. And, you know, when I took over, and I had been with the organization for 5 years prior to taking over, one of the first things I did for myself, I cut the executive director salary, right? Like, because I realized that money should go back to the community. I'm a Baltimore guy. I'm community focused. We have been building community programs for the last five, six years. And so we have a Safe Streets post that we have in our office.
Safe Streets, the violence interruption.
Violence interruption, yeah, which has done a great job.
And so is that funded? Is your post funded with some of this?
This year, some of the money is for this year, some of the money for Safe Streets is coming through slots. I have several education programs, including a community schools outpost at Arlington Elementary Middle School. We have a hippie program, which is in-home instruction for young people and their families, pre-K. You know, we're doing a lot of things in the community. And like I said, we haven't been doing development like for the last 4 or 5 years. We did build one senior housing building, which is a great success. But all that time, we realized we have to work towards making the community better. We have to help people. You know, my clean and green team, I employ like at any given time, 7 to 10 people in the clean and green. They're all neighborhood residents. So, you know, I believe in the community. I give back to the community. I work in the community. This is what I've done over the last 2 years. I can't speak to what was done in the past, but I know that's my focus. But, you know, there are always going to be folks who question that. But we just have to move forward, you know, keep working.
Is the bricks and mortar part, the real estate part? You listed four priorities, which I jotted down and now cannot read. But I remember that real estate was the last,
yeah.
after safety, education, beautification.
Yeah.
If the real estate part just doesn't happen, mm-hmm. but those other three do, and you just described some efforts in those three directions, is that not success?
That is success. Actually, you know, like I said, I come from a finance and development background. And I realize, I mean, and once again, I'm a Baltimore guy and I've grown up in the city. You know, in the 90s, I've seen the blight. And you have to help the people. You got to create jobs. You got to create a safe environment. For me, that's paramount, right? Like Safe Streets has to be there and work in. And then we have to work in conjunction with the police and Citizens on Patrol. I can't redevelop in a neighborhood where people are afraid they're going to get shot, right? I mean, that just doesn't make any sense. And so we have to focus our efforts in those areas as well. And then, you know, you attract that real estate development investment in a lot of places. So
the bundling of community interest in an organization like his is super important. I mean, it's kind of interesting that the total size of Park Heights is about the total size of this Port Covington that we have been mm-hmm. talking forever and ever. Mm-hmm. And it is so good that we are talking today about Park Heights. And to be at the table in the city, at the departments, and to represent the interest of a neighborhood like Park Heights, which is really many neighborhoods, it is so key that there is an organization like his that is there, that bundles interest and leverages improvements and does foreclosure counseling and all these other things that they are doing. So I would certainly hope that the folks that live in the community don't think that money is wasted. This is a strategic step to build capacity and be at the table and have a voice so that the other powerful folks are not always, you know, just having all the attention.
Mm-hmm. Nate has called us from Baltimore. Nate, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello.
Cheo, how are you?
I'm well.
My name is Nate Udofia. I'm the chief executive and president of Grid Development Partners. We were one of the community partners that submitted for the redevelopment effort. in Central Park Heights. And I had a couple of quick comments and a question. First one is, the human capital development was one of the strategies for development that we focused in on, where we wanted to integrate community resilience into the plan, utilizing an anchor such as Sinai to start a development with an introduction of something economically viable for the community where they shared in the energy growth. What is your thoughts on utilizing that as a strategy moving forward, given that there seems to be a shift in the development strategy?
I appreciate the question, Nate. Klaus, I know it's a question for Cheo, and we will. But I'm struck because Nate's talking about partnering with Sinai, and that seems to be maybe I'm missing the full import. It seems to me to sort of match what you were saying about where you think nodes of development should be.
Right, partnering with stakeholders and community anchors, and you know, the hospital and health system is directly related and should be related. And the University of Maryland and Hopkins have taken a long time until they realized that they need to engage in the community, but now they're both doing this, and I'm sure Sinai Healthbridge will do the same thing, although I don't know the details in this, and Cheo will probably answer that.
Yeah, and like I said earlier, I mean, Sinai, Neil Meltzer, Amy Perry, Martha Nathanson, Izzy Patoka, I mean, that team that they have over there, they are all in. I mean, they're really engaged with Park Heights Renaissance. They're engaged with wanting to see positive things happen in the community. They're trying to work with us. They're really really taking our lead with respect to the development piece.
What do you mean by they have taken our lead?
They're listening to what PHR, because everybody knows PHR is the authority to do the redevelopment, to work with the city to do the redevelopment. You know, on their land, they do their thing, but they want to be engaged in the community, and they're just trying to figure out the best ways to do that, right? Like, they can't necessarily just jump out there and start buying up a bunch of property on Belvedere and say, well, we're going to take over. I mean, that's not a true community strategy. They want to be engaged in the fabric of the community, and if they do development, right, they want to do meaningful development. If they invest with us or other community groups, they wanted to have some impact, and they wanted to be really thoughtful. And so that's what I think myself, our organization does, a lot of other community groups, I think that's what they do as well. Really, we're trying to have a true comprehensive strategy on where to develop, how to develop, where do we fix schools, what areas need better policing, what areas need less liquor stores, how do we address, you know, the drug trade in certain areas. You know, I mean, it's 100 different things that it'll take to change Park Heights. But listen, it didn't get like this overnight, right? And it's not going to change overnight. And so we just got to keep working hard and trying to figure out the best strategies and looking at best practices around the country and also within our city.
When we talk about Park Heights or Sandtown or East Baltimore or many of the other disinvested communities under stress, it is really always helpful to have the big picture in mind. Where is the city as a whole going? And, you know, we're going to have a new mayor in December. And my take on this is that it takes only somewhere around 50 to 100,000 people, and we can fill most of our neighborhoods back up because we don't need the 300,000 people back that we lost. We need only the households back that we lost. And there are now, you know, much smaller households. There are much fewer people in them, and they take up much more space. So it's not a totally hopeless situation that this core city would capture only 10% or so of the regional growth and directed back into the city. And when you have that perspective that you really want to bring the neighborhoods back with their authenticity and their culture and everything, with a new diversity, that means, you know, the folks that are on the ground have to accept new people coming in, but it's also not taking them all out or pushing them out. That would be the hope. Then you are not going in and demolish everything. Then you are not going and bulldoze everything, because when you have the hope that these communities get a new life, then you need to keep their authenticity.
Because you mentioned Greenmount earlier as a success story in Bacon's to Values, let me ask Dale whether he can quickly make his point.
Sure. Yes, I'm the former president of Greenmount West, and excuse me, it's been a success to some extent, and it hasn't been to other extents because most of the properties that were in the vacant value, we had a very comprehensive census of the properties, and we were very strategic on how they were rolled out. And then our proximity to lots of different things made it a pretty much a success story in our neighborhood. But I know in other neighborhoods, houses are being received, and they're not being redeveloped. So it's not, and my biggest gripe is the economic development has not come with the investment. And there's been over $100 million of investment in about a quarter of a mile from my house. So it hasn't been balanced. We do have a master plan. We have to temper people's expectations about reality. But in some instances, our public officials and stuff are not doing their part as far as filling that portion of the mandate.
Dale, I appreciate your making the point. Is this a cautionary tale for Park Heights Renaissance?
Well, absolutely. I mean, listen. Our city is 63% African American. I mean, anybody who reads the news knows that African Americans have been for 100 years plus, treated unfairly, right? I mean, if you look at the stats, I mean, our unemployment, our education levels, et cetera, and just the whole piece with the redlining throughout Baltimore City, right? Like, so we are still suffering from laws, right? Laws created by people who we elected that were detrimental to African Americans. And so people expect that overnight a neighborhood would change when you had a whole system against a whole race of people, right? And that's what's going on in Baltimore. And so how do we change that, right? How do we change politicians, how do we get people in these communities to force those who we elect to not make these type of laws, to create job opportunities, to step up to the plate, right? We all got to work together to do that. And so, it's going to take some time, but we got to just keep working.
We have a half minute left.
Yeah.
What happens next?
So what happens next is we met with the community and we're going out and we're going to start planning strategic development. But we're going to continue doing the things that I talked about. We're going to continue to focus on safety, education, and beautification first. We want to expand our safe streets. We want to expand our clean and green team. We want to work with the new mayor. She's very engaged.
Will you keep in touch
successful.
With us?
Yes.
All right.
absolutely.
I want to thank you both. You've opened
thank
our
you,
eyes
thanks,
about
Paul.
A lot of things. Cheo Hurley is executive director of the nonprofit Park Heights Renaissance. Cheo Hurley also serves on the Planning Commission and, full disclosure, on WYPR's board. And I want to thank urban planner and architect Klaus Philipson of Arc Plan Incorporated for coming into the studio today. Thank you. And also thanks to Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. 240 years ago, just weeks after the Continental Congress had declared independence from Britain, George Washington's troops were outnumbered and outmaneuvered in the Battle of Brooklyn. We'll talk to military historian Patrick O'Donnell about the remarkable regiment from Maryland that held the British at bay. I'm Sheila Cast. Enjoy this fabulous afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.